Welcome to this Forthright Radio for March 4th, 2020. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today. We spoke yesterday with journalist Catherine Stewart about her latest book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, which had just been released that day by Bloomsbury Publishing. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, The New York Times, Reuters, The Atlantic, Bloomberg View, Newsweek International, Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, The Nation, Alternate, The Daily Beast, and much more. Welcome to Forthright Radio, Catherine Stewart.
Oh, it's great to be here, Joy. Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine, your earlier book is The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. And your latest book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, has just been released by Bloomsbury Publishing. In it, you focus on Christian nationalism. Just what is Christian nationalism?
Christian nationalism is a political ideology that ties the idea of America to very distinct religious and cultural identities. It says that what makes our country great and distinctive is not our democratic system of governance or our constitution or our long, if imperfect, history of assimilating very diverse people into a pluralist society. Instead, its representatives insist that the foundation of legitimate government in the United States is bound up inextricably with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion. It says that essentially the U.S. is founded on the Bible rather than the Constitution and can succeed only if it stays true to this foundation. Christian nationalism is also a very effective device for mobilizing and often manipulating large segments of the population and for concentrating power in the hands of a new elite. Christian nationalism bears many features with other forms of religious nationalism around the world, and we can see how that works in consolidating power in the hands of a new elite. So when Putin in Russia or Erdogan in Turkey bind themselves closely to religious conservatives in their countries to consolidate an authoritarian form of power, we rightly understand that as a form of religious nationalism. We're seeing this today with Trump's alliances with our own religious hyper-conservatives in our country.
Yes, and also with Mr. Putin. Let's dissect this. What do we mean by Christian in this sense? Because Christian could mean a lot of different things to a lot of people.
Absolutely. It's obvious, but it bears repeating that Christianity is not the same thing as Christian nationalism. Of course, Christianity in America is an extraordinarily diverse religion, politically and in terms of political orientation, in terms of theology. And many people refer to the movement as a movement of white evangelicalism, but this really isn't quite right. The movement I'm describing includes many people who identify as evangelicals, both white and non-white, I should say, but it excludes many evangelicals too. And it includes conservative representatives of other varieties of Protestant and non-Protestant religion. A great many Christians oppose the movement, and quite a few question whether it is authentically Christian in the first place. I'm thinking about people like Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, who I recently shared a stage with at Union Theological Seminary. He's part of an evangelical movement that opposes the politics of conquest and division that the movement represents.
Is it possible to summarize what Christian nationalism stands for? Is there a theological element that can be identified?
The theology is diverse, but it's interesting. What happens with religious nationalism is actually that the politics comes first and the denomination comes second. So people often get confused by the denominational labels. In America, as I mentioned, the movement includes conservative representatives of various types of both Protestant and non-Protestant religion. So in a sense, it's a new form of religion that cuts across denomination.
What are the unifying elements of the politics?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joy. I think more than ever, it's adherents view political questions in religious terms, and they see political and public policy as a way of realizing those religious goals.
What I'm hoping that we can do is to get to some of the specifics because, as you document in your book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, Catherine Stewart, there are unifying elements, which is what allows them to have the power that they have now.
Absolutely, Joy. This is so important. I think that it's helpful in understanding what the issues are that unify the movement and distinguishing between the leaders and the followers. The foot soldiers may believe that they're fighting for things like a traditional marriage or a ban on abortion when the leaders are talking to the rank and file or even to pastors who are then going to be communicating issues to their congregants. It's all abortion all the time. Abortion is the beginning and the end. But over time, the movement's leaders and strategists have consciously reframed these culture war issues in order to capture and control the votes of these people. They understand that if you can get people to vote on a couple of issues, the three issues that they often mention are abortion, same-sex marriage, or the defense of the traditional family, and what they call religious liberty, which is often a license to discriminate. So they use these issues to solidify and maintain political power for themselves and their allies, and to increase the flow of public and private money in their direction. So, yes, when they're talking with one another, they're always talking about abortion. But when you hear what the leaders say in the forums that they share, or when they're talking to their funders, they have incredibly expansive positions on domestic policy, economic policy, and foreign policy. And that hits home the fact that Christian nationalism really is a political movement. So I want to just give you an example of that. There's this very politically connected pastor named Ralph Drollinger. He has a ministry called Capital Ministries. I write about him in my book, where he targets political leaders. At least 11 out of 15 members of Trump's cabinet have attended, and he also holds Bible study groups for members of Congress. So you can see he's one of the most politically connected religious leaders. He targets political leaders at the highest level of government. Well, in his Bible study guides, which he teaches to these political leaders, I'll just give an example. He sort of casts the social safety net as unbiblical. He writes, "The responsibility to meet the needs of the poor lie first with a husband in marriage, secondly with a family, if the husband is absent, and thirdly with the church." And he writes, "Nowhere does God command the institutions of government or commerce to fully support those with genuine need." So other Bible studies that Drollinger produces promote deregulation. They're against environmental regulation, regulation for business. He thinks that the flat tax, he casts this as a biblical tax. And he also has a Bible study in which he compares submitting to one's boss, as he calls it, with a principle that's mandated in the book of Peter. So when you hear the expansiveness of these policy positions talk about biblical economics and the like, you really see that this is, it sort of hits home the fact that this is not a culture war. This is really a political movement.
And that also then brings up the nexus between the proponents of Christian nationalism and the oligarchy in the United States and around the world. Talk about that nexus.
In recent years, the movement has come to depend critically on the wealth of a growing subset of America's plutocratic class, many of whom are committed to low taxation and a minimally regulated economy, as much or even more so as they are to right-wing positions in the so-called culture wars. I write about many of these plutocratic funders in my book. Some of them are members of hyper-wealthy extended families. I'm thinking about the DeVos Prince families. As you know, Betsy DeVos's extended family played a critical role in funding some of the leading policy groups of the religious right. They also donated millions of dollars to figures like the hyper-conservative preacher D. James Kennedy, who abhorred public education. It's very interesting that her family donated, I think we found something like $5.5 million or more to Kennedy's ministry, and he produced pamphlets in which he decried public education as unbiblical and atheistic and that type of thing. And here she is, education secretary now. It's quite interesting. Other families include the Green family. Steve Green is one of the founder of the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. There are so many other very plutocratic funders, some of whom are very committed to politics of minimal taxation for business. And that's an important feature to remember about the movement. This is an aspect of the movement that, again, shares features with other forms of religious nationalism around the globe. I went to an event called the World Congress of Families in Verona, Italy. It's a gathering of what they call the global conservative movement. It takes place every few years, sometimes every year, depending. And religious nationalists at these events collaborate in a declared war on what its practitioners identify as global liberalism. They really want to replace what they call global liberalism. They consider this a great enemy with a different system of governance. Again, they use these culture war issues to reach the rank and file. They attack women's rights, LGBT equality, and more. But they're really after something much deeper when you hear what the speakers at these events have to say. And they understand that this is an international struggle. And so they have formed important alliances that cross borders.
Catherine Stewart, you show throughout your book that you do go to these conferences in the United States and around the world. So you hear what they're actually saying instead of what their publicity is saying. Let's stick for a little bit longer to the work of the World Congress of Families. Globalism is kind of a shibboleth bugaboo on many levels, and it's used by different groups to mean different things and to mobilize people for different reasons. They're calling the problem global liberalism, but at the same time, they are doing incredible outreach through things such as the Child Evangelical Fellowship, which began in 1937. Share with our listeners what that work does, which is now in 180 countries.
That's right. The Child Evangelism Fellowship started in Warrenton, Missouri in 1937. And I do have to mention that my journey into this area began when an outreach initiative of the Child Evangelism Fellowship came to my daughter's public school in Santa Barbara, California. This was back in 2009. The initiative was called the Good News Club. And believe it or not, there are thousands of Good News Clubs operating in public elementary schools across the country. Good News Clubs are designed to convert little children in their various years of learning, often too young to read, into a deeply fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. Now, of course, these types of clubs have operated for years uncontroversially in churches and people's private homes and sometimes in public parks. But I was astonished to discover that they were operating in public schools, which, after all, are meant to serve all students of all faiths and all families, a diverse population. And the message they give these elementary age kids is that they will go to hell without Jesus. And in our community, I saw how these clubs confuse little kids into thinking that their school supported a particular form of religion. And the adults leading the club, because they're led by adults, not kids, they use their position inside the schools to get kids attending the clubs to recruit and proselytize and often bully their non-attending non-Christian classmates or children who belong to the quote-unquote wrong religion. They would sort of identify who is not a Christian and target them and try and get them to join the club with them or who's going to the wrong kind of church. So I thought these clubs were wildly inappropriate in a diverse public school environment. But I also sort of thought at first that they were a relic of the American past. And it turns out I was wrong about that. And the more I learned about the clubs, the more stunned I became about the coherence of the movement behind them. Good News Clubs, again, are just one of many of these types of global initiatives reaching people around the world with this message of biblical literalism, and along with it comes a particular type of political message. I mean, religious nationalism, there are many features in different countries that are distinctive to those countries, but I think it's important to note that each defines itself against a common enemy, which is the global liberalism. This is a theme I heard over and over at the World Congress of Families, and the values of the Enlightenment, the values of equality, LGBT equality, the rights of women. And again, in looking at this global picture, I'm consistently impressed with the sophistication of the movement's political machinery and its organization.
Let's stick with the Good News Clubs for just a moment. In the case of the Good News Clubs versus Milford Central School, the issue of whether they're using the public schools' facilities was a violation of the Establishment Clause. And none other than Jay Sekulow, who is currently famous for being part of the defense team in the recent impeachment hearing against Donald J. Trump, came up with a way to work around the Establishment Clause. Talk about that, please.
That's great. It's a really interesting area. I mean, the legal arguments are convoluted. I'm going to summarize them very, very quickly. They argued that religion isn't really religion. It's speech from a certain point of view. And therefore, these activities should be allowed because of this free speech clause of the First Amendment. So let's just look at this on the face. Is religion just speech from a certain point of view? Well, not according to our tax code. Religions enjoy substantial tax privileges and subsidies and benefits that no other non-religious nonprofits enjoy. They have all kinds of special benefits like parsonage exemptions. They're exempt from transparency requirements that other nonprofit, non-religious organizations have. Is religion treated the same as other forms of speech in our legal code? Well, no, it's not. Religious groups are free from, they don't have to adhere to the same kind of anti-discrimination laws that non-religious nonprofits have to adhere to. So let's just say you had an environmental organization and they said, we're a non-religious nonprofit, but we exclude women from leadership. Well, that wouldn't be right. Or if they said, we just don't allow gay people or everybody in our leadership position has to have blonde hair. Well, they would be subject to, you know, all kinds of lawsuits because you're not allowed to do that if you're a non-religious nonprofit. But religions are allowed to discriminate precisely because they're religious groups. They can exclude LGBT Americans from leadership or women from leadership, or they can even exclude people of different ethnicities, as many religions have done until very recently. So it's precisely because they have these special benefits and exemptions and subsidies that religion enjoys a very distinct position in our tax code, in our legal code. But when it was convenient for this movement to try to force their way into public schools, which they called the mission fields, and they referred to our children as the harvest, they argued, oh, we're not really religion after all. We're just speech from a certain point of view. So, you know, the legal arguments are convoluted, but let's look at the effects on the ground. If public schools are to function effectively, especially public elementary schools are to function effectively in a diverse society, we need to set aside our religious agendas, our political agendas, and come together in support of our youngest children and their future. We don't need to be igniting these needless religious wars in public school playgrounds. I mean, public schools have a kind of cloak of authority in the minds of children at this age. They think if it's happening in a public school, it must be what their public school wants them to believe. And that fact has created havoc in a lot of the public schools where Good News Clubs have installed themselves. In our own public school, you know, we had a very diverse, largely Christian, but very diverse population, as most public schools are. We had perhaps a third to a half of the parent body was evangelical. And many of those parents did not want a Good News Club coming to our school. In fact, a group of them met with the leaders of the Good News Club and said, you know, we're evangelical. We believe in the Great Commission, too. But you're just not right for our school. And they actually offered them, this is great joy, they offered them free and better space in the evangelical church next door to the school, maybe 20 yards away. It's called the Montecito Covenant Church. It's an absolutely beautiful church, stunning, free space, better space in my view. At the same time, Good News Club leaders declined. They insisted on being in the public school. So their arguments that they have nowhere to meet and that therefore they need to exploit the public schools, taxpayer-funded spaces in order to even have the clubs is really false. And the fact that so many evangelical parents in our school thought that this group was too divisive and not right for a public school community, and the Good News Club leaders declined their generous offer, was one of the events that really propelled my investigation into this area.
We're speaking with Catherine Stewart. Her latest book just out is The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. Well, that brings up church planting.
Thanks for bringing that up, Joy. Church planting in public schools is something that I have written about. I first got interested in the topic when we moved from Santa Barbara to New York City, and I realized we lived across the street from our public school, and I realized that a Dominionist church was operating 4 days a week and paying no rent in our public school. So I attended the church because I like attending church. It's very interesting, and just kind of figure out what it was all about. And the pastor said, "Notice the names and pictures of the children on the pieces of paper around you." Well, we had put our children's names and pictures on pieces of paper and sort of put them up on the walls of the public school so that kids could notice themselves as they walk into the school. And he said, "Pray for them. Pray for that they and their families will come to know Jesus." And I thought, well, it's kind of astonishing. Here I am, mandated by law to send my children to this public school, and where their images and their names are going to get involved in the religious ceremonies of a group that believes we're going to hell. I mean, it just seemed kind of astonishing to me. So I just got interested in the whole dynamic of church planting in public schools. The head of the church claimed that they were paying rent. Well, they weren't paying a cent of rent to the Department of Education. They were paying a facility use fee, which was something in the tens of dollars when they were operating. And basically, they were acquiring free space, free heating and cooling, a safe place with the sort of stamp of government authority, all the furniture. We, the parents, actually had to pay money to renovate the bathrooms because our public school was strapped for cash. So we donated lots of money to, you know, paint the facility and to renovate the bathrooms that this religious group is then using. And this seems to me like an unacceptable establishment of religion. This is precisely what our founding fathers meant to guard against when they baked into the principle of the Constitution the idea that taxpayer money should not be used to fund religion. And yet here, astonishingly, my taxpayer dollars were funding the religious activities of a group that was meeting in our public school 4 days a week.
How common is church planting in the United States?
It's very common. At the time that I started writing about the initiative, I looked at the New York City public school system, and it involved a lot of phone calling, and I discovered at least 180 churches operating rent-free in New York City's public schools. And church planting in public schools occurs nationwide. I'm going to tell you something interesting. I've been to many of these churches planted in public schools, and if you start to drill into their documents, some of the documents that they produce to elaborate on their theology, you'll often find language advocating things like patriarchy at home and in church. In one church that I attended, they literally denigrated other faiths, Catholicism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They were denigrating, above all, liberal Christianity in their documents that they handed out in their courses. And yet they're operating in a publicly funded public schools. This is, in my view, an unacceptable mixing of religion and government, our taxpayer dollars should not be basically paying and subsidizing religious groups that advocate for discrimination and contempt for various faith groups, of course.
Let's get into the roots of the current Christian nationalism. You talk about Christian Reconstructionism.
If you look at the roots of religious nationalism in America, you can see a through line to Reconstructionism and the pro-slavery theologians. A little bit more recently, you can look at people like James Fifield, a founder of an influential theological intellectual movement called Spiritual Mobilization. These folks were convinced that only conservative theology could save capitalism. He received funding from plutocrats of large corporations like Sun Oil and Chrysler, and he produced sermons and writings intended to steer people away from liberal Christianity, labor unions, public assistance programs, and the like. But these folks were replicating some of the positions, in many respects, of the pro-slavery theologians of the previous century, who, following emancipation, railed against religious liberalism themselves and complained that white people should not have to pay taxes to provide services to black people, such as education for their children. I'm thinking about theologians such as Robert Louis Dabney, who also railed against public schools as promoting atheistic unbelief. Theirs was a vision of America that is very similar in some ways to the vision of some of the leading thinkers of Christian nationalism today. The idea of America is an authentically Christian nation rooted in biblical literalism, the need for an absolute submission to authority with hierarchies that are ordained by God. These types of themes persist. And it's interesting to note that a lot of Christian nationalists today try to cast themselves as inheritors of the tradition of abolitionists, many of whom were, in fact, themselves very religious and argued in religious terms against slavery. But if you look at those folks like Reverend Calvin Fairbanks or Charles Grandison Finney or John Leland or William Wilberforce, they were actually arguing for a more liberal expression of Christianity. And many of them also advocated for things like women's equality. But it was really the other side, the sort of religious biblical literalists and the conservatives that were promoting slavery at the time. Frederick Douglass himself observed that abolitionists tended to be distinctly disempowered minorities in their own denominations. And he wrote that a few heterodox and still fewer orthodox ministers filling humble pulpits and living upon small salaries have espoused the cause of the slave. So he's saying that it's the poor ones, the sort of disempowered clerics that are promoting abolition. But he said, ministers of high standing were almost to a man on the side of slavery. Look, I think it's really important to remember that representatives of major denominations in the South, for sure, were either promoting slavery, endorsing slavery, or had somehow made their peace with it. And when they criticized abolitionism on a deeper level, it was part of a kind of counter-revolutionary response to the perceived liberal and irreligious, as they saw it, excesses associated with the American Revolution.
You've titled your book, The Power Worshippers, Catherine Stewart. Are you implying in that it's less about religion and more about power?
Yes, thank you. Indeed, this movement really is more about power than it is about theology. There are many distinctive theologies involved in various people who are part of the movement. For many people who attend, for instance, churches where their votes are directed by their pastors, they would not think of themselves as members of the movement. Many members of the rank and file vote for things like what they see as a defense of traditional marriage and an end to abortion, and they really see their votes as honoring what they call their biblical values. But over time, leaders of the movement have recast these issues in such a way as to obtain more political power for themselves and for their political allies. They have found a way to control people's votes in order to maintain political power. I mean, I think it's really important to understand, and I write about this a lot in my book, that leaders of the movement understand that pastors drive votes. And therefore, they've made a concerted effort to reach out to many pastors to draw them into networks and then communicate to them the right issues, the sort of correct biblical view of the issues in order to capture and to control votes of a large subsection of the American public.
Go into that in greater detail, which you do in your book, The Power Worshippers, Catherine Stewart. Talk about the details, the minutiae of their get out the vote efforts. It is really quite startling.
Thank you. I would love to talk about that. I mean, if you look at what really happens on the ground, it's quite astonishing. I found myself in rural North Carolina attending a gathering of Watchmen on the Wall. Watchmen on the Wall is an initiative of the Family Research Council. It's one of the most powerful right-wing policy groups. And they have this network called Watchmen on the Wall. They claim to have 25,000 pastor members at least. And they hold policy briefings in these key states where they're getting pastors together and trying to get them all sort of on the same page. And they give them lots of messaging tools that they can use in their sermons to communicate to their congregants how to vote their biblical values. So they give them voter guides that supposedly rank candidates on the issues that are supposed to matter: always abortion, defense of traditional marriage, anti-LGBT equality, and the like. And they also give them other very sophisticated messaging tools. Sometimes they'll provide them with videos that they can air in church. I went to another pastor gathering in Chula Vista, California, where one of the speakers who was addressing dozens of pastors said, "We can do this presentation. If you don't want to do it, we can come to your church and do it for you. We'll go down the ballot. And if you want to do it, we have all these tools so you can do it yourself." And tools included very specific talking points. So as you can see, the movement understands that by reaching thousands of pastors, they can reach millions of voters. And they also make an effort to reach these in specific swing districts, in particular at the times that it's going to matter most. I remember I was at a Road to Majority conference. I was listening to Ralph Reed. He's one of the leaders of another very powerful right-wing policy group. And he declared that the organization was going to invest $50 million in get out the vote efforts in 2020. He said there's going to be a special focus on swing states and Latino voters of faith. And he said that the effort was going to include 500 paid staff and 5,000 volunteers. So as you can see, they're really very strategic in how they do their targeting and where they devote their resources.
Well, let's talk about even more specifically, and particularly the voter data collection, 200 million files. They've got personality files. And this is not restricted just to church members. 89% of the U.S. population they've got files on. This is certainly a bit chilling.
Thank you, Joy, for mentioning that. I have an article about United in Purpose in the current issue of The Guardian. United in Purpose, to be clear, is not itself Koch-funded, but there's another right-wing voter initiative, I360, that is Koch-funded. But what we're seeing with these different types of initiatives is that the right is working with incredibly sophisticated data machines. And a leader of the United in Purpose, I don't have the quote in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase it. He said something like, "We have 200 million voter files in our databases, and we know what makes someone get out to vote, and we know what makes them stay at home." I mean, think about that. It's quite a chilling quote. He has gone a bit quiet as of late, but I found a number of videos that had been posted online where he's doing interviews with the Christian Broadcasting Network, Truth and Liberty Coalition, and other organizations. And I watched all of the ones that I could find, and he revealed quite a bit about how his voter turnout machine actually works.
Well, let's get even more focused on that, because this is really relevant in this 2020 election year. I don't remember which organization. There were quite a few organizations that you've documented. They offer services that track at the church level who among the church members is registered, who has voted. If by 4 o'clock in the afternoon or something, a particular church member hasn't voted, they will contact them, send cars. And we're not talking about people there near their church. We're talking about a more centralized organization.
That quote actually is something that Ralph Reed said that his organization was going to do. And I found that astonishing. This is in the run-up to the 2016 election. He was talking about all the resources that his organization was going to bring to bear on the 2016 election. And when I heard that, I really thought to myself, gosh, they really have it together. It's kind of extraordinary. I mean, United in Purpose has its own tools, so I'm just going to give you one of them. They offer a special toolkit for pastors, and they have a ministry consultant who will work with each church to help them get their people out to vote on election day. One of the pastor initiative called Project 75 promises to mobilize what they call 75% of church members to vote. They have a tool called the Church Voter Lookup Tool, which promises to run a church database all at once, provide report on what percentage of a congregation is registered to vote, what percentage actually voted in the last election, and then at the end of each election, they provide a follow-up report to sort of track progress. And it's basically a tool that's designed to help pastors figure out who is voting in their congregation, what percentage is voting, and perhaps offering them, they could be making use of tools that will be intended to turn out larger proportions of their congregations to vote. So they really understand that in America today, vast numbers of conservative churches have been turned, unfortunately, into the cells, silent cells of a shadow political party.
Well, what about the Johnson Amendment? Explain what the Johnson Amendment is and why isn't it being more used and more effective in preserving non-religious involvement in politics, is it?
I think the Johnson Amendment is a principle that's been violated so much at this point, it barely has any meaning at all. The Johnson Amendment is an amendment that's supposed to prevent pastors from politicking from the pulpit. Pastors are not supposed to advocate for political candidates from the pulpit. This is one of the reasons for the tax-exempt status of churches and for their special exemptions, their special benefits, the lack of financial transparency, and the like. But Trump has repeatedly said he's going to do away with the Johnson Amendment. Although, interestingly, I just feel like it, on the ground, it really has little teeth anymore at all, because given all these data tools that we're looking at and given the messaging tools that we're seeing today, the Johnson Amendment, the spirit is violated all the time. Sometimes at these events, the leaders will stand up and say, I'm not politicking, this is a nonpartisan event. But then as soon as they start talking, it becomes clear that it's a deeply partisan event. There's no doubt whatsoever which way pastors are supposed to direct their congregants to vote. I remember one event I attended, Tony Perkins stood up and he said, you know, he cast the political enemies, these are political opponents, not as people with honest differences of opinion, but as people who are associated with what he called the forces of darkness. I mean, I think this is something that's very dangerous about the current movement of religious nationalism. They're really not casting their political opponents as people who might have differences in terms of healthcare policy or in terms of ideas about non-discrimination law or people who are promoting pluralism. They're really casting their political opponents as demonic. And if you look at a leader like Trump, he's not even pretending to represent all Americans. At this last March for Life in Washington, D.C., he stood up in the crowd and he said, they are coming after me because I am fighting for you. And he said, the far left is actively working to erase our God-given rights. Well, nobody's actively trying to erase anybody's God-given rights here. It's really about creating a persecution narrative. And that's what religious nationalisms do. There is an us which is a sort of anointed or elected ones or the people in the sort of right group, and then there is a them, which is sort of their opponents, and they often demonize or cast as, you know, dehumanize or cast as completely unacceptable the other group.
We've covered the American Legislative Exchange Committee for years and years, and there's an equivalent here, Project Blitz, and what you call a Christian nationalist blitz. Would you describe that to our listeners, please?
Thanks for asking. The Project Blitz is an initiative, the idea of which is to overwhelm state legislatures with bills like ALEC that are based on centrally manufactured legislation. David Barton, who is a sort of Christian nationalist historian and one of four members of Project Blitz steering team, said it's kind of like whack-a-mole with the other side. It'll drive them crazy that they'll have to divide their resources opposing this. So let's give an example on the ground. They'll craft an In God We Trust bill and send it out to multiple states and mandates the addition of signs saying In God We Trust in public schools. One could think, what's the problem just putting, you know, In God We Trust in public schools? But as authors of Project Blitz and leaders of Project Blitz make clear, these types of initiatives are, this is the, just the first level of their initiatives. They've grouped their model legislation into three categories according to anticipated level of difficulty of passage. So the first category does consist of these symbolic gestures, like In God We Trust signs. But then they go into the second level, which is a level that's intended to degrade the separation of church and state even further, and a means of spreading the message that Christian conservatives are the real Americans, and everyone else here is just here by invitation only. And these types of initiatives include the teaching and celebration of Christianity in public schools and elsewhere. Now, there's a third level of category of this model legislation, and this category really allows a license to discriminate by conservative Christians and not other groups when it conflicts with their religious beliefs. So, for instance, if conservative Christians decide that their religious beliefs mean that they don't want to have to provide health care to somebody who's trans, that's their right. They can just decline to provide health care to that person. But if you're, say, a pregnant woman entering a hospital, let's just give an example, and you decide that your care should be based on the Hippocratic Oath and best practices rather than somebody else's religion, there's no liberty in these bills for you. So what these bills end up doing is licensing a certain type of discrimination by one group against another.
I'm glad you brought up the medicine part, because one of your sections talks about hospitals and ethical and religious directives. And you had a personal experience. I don't know if you wish to share it or not, but it was really quite shocking. My question is, how can religious beliefs override the Hippocratic Oath, and why aren't suits being brought against hospitals when there are dire consequences for malpractice or failing to operate to the standards, that sort of thing?
Thank you so much for bringing that up, Joy. And this is difficult for me to talk about, but I do think it's important because the leaders of the Christian nationalist movement are constantly mischaracterizing abortion, lying about it. One of the lies that I hear frequently is that abortion is never necessary to save the life of a mother. As I discuss in my book, I started hemorrhaging during a pregnancy. My husband and I were trying for a second child, and I did have to have a D&C procedure, which the right chooses to characterize as abortion, in order to save my life. But unfortunately, I was taken by ambulance to a Catholic hospital. Catholic hospitals decline to perform some of these procedures, and they don't treat women in need of certain types of medical care according to best practices medicine. Frequently, they'll delay miscarriage care or deny a woman who's undergoing a miscarriage admittance to emergency rooms. And this is a terribly traumatic experience for me, but I also discovered that it happens to large numbers of women, and it's very rarely talked about. It's hard to find a woman who wants to lay bare the worst day of her life and her most traumatic experiences in order to prove to the world, which should not have to be proven, that pregnancy carries a significant risk and medical care in these circumstances ought to be guided by best practices medicine and not religious dogma. A few years later, I served as an investigator for an American Civil Liberties Union report on the consequences of this type of denial of care in Catholic healthcare facilities, not just a denial of miscarriage care, but other types of denial of care. They refuse to prescribe birth control as birth control and the like. They won't do things like, you know, for women need to have, or men who need to have their tubes tied or want to go that type of procedure, they won't do that. And the health consequences on the ground are really astonishing. There are people who have suffered so much more than I have. I found cases of doctors who said that they treated women who were, their care was delayed so long they became septic, suffered cognitive injury. I mean, I just found some really horrific stories, some of which the families don't want to make public, so I have to respect their decisions. I will say that, you know, when this horrible case happened in Ireland of this poor woman who entered a hospital, which is a Catholic facility, she was miscarrying. I think she had become septic. Something was going wrong with the pregnancy, and they refused to treat her, and she ended up dying. I think we can safely say that you really don't need to look overseas to find some of the most dire consequences of this type of refusal of care. This kind of astonishing abrogation of the Hippocratic Oath is happening here in America as well.
You do share in your book that as a result of their failure to provide the proper care, you lost 40% of your blood. That just is awful. And meanwhile, as hospitals are being consolidated around the country, the number of hospitals being controlled by the Catholic Church and Catholic, these sorts of directives is on the rise. Am I right about that?
That's true. And in many parts of the country, it's very difficult if you're trying to get care to find it in a non-Catholic healthcare setting. Not only that, but the religious directives don't just apply to hospitals. They apply in many instances to some of their partner providers, like doctors who have admitting privileges have to adhere to what they call the ethical and religious directives. When I was researching this area, I found a number of doctors who were quite upset about this situation. They said, listen, we want the kind of care we deliver to be based on best practices. And we think that women should be allowed in consultation with their families to allow their own religious principles and their own principles of conscience to direct the kind of care we receive. One doctor, he joked, he said, there's a man in the Vatican who's telling a Jewish doctor what kind of care he should be offering to his Buddhist patient. And it was a kind of joke saying that this is really not about religious liberty. It's really about a kind of imposition, an imposition of a single type of religious belief on people of different religious perspectives and different faiths.
Well, I very much regret, Catherine Stewart, that we are out of time. I want to give you 30 seconds for final words to our listeners.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on this show. I want to say that religious nationalism, while it's a real concern, should not be a cause for losing hope. I mean, religious nationalists are using the tools of modern democracy to destroy democracy, but I continue to believe that we can use these same tools to restore it. We have the right for now to political activism. The right has invested heavily in data, media, and messaging. There's no reason people who oppose the politics of conquest and division can't engage in that too. We can engage with other voters. We can, as the right does, look beyond the personality quirks of any particular political candidate and look a little bit deeper. Who are the justices they're going to appoint to the Supreme Court and the lower courts? What type of people are they going to put in charge of the cabinet? And above all, I think that separation of church and state is not something that's just for atheists, and it's not just something that's a meaningless phrase. That's something that was baked into our First Amendment, and it's more than that, you know, principle that served our country very well since our nation's founding. I think we should do all we can to restore it.
Well, Catherine Stewart, thank you for your work over these years and for joining us today on Forthright Radio. We very much appreciate it.
Thanks. It's really great to speak with you too, Joy.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been journalist Catherine Stewart. Her latest book is The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, which has just been released by Bloomsbury Publishing. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. Thanks to Alicia Bales, Program Director at KZYX, for production assistance with today's show. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media. Forthright Radio returns a fortnight from today. Our guest will be Betsy Quammen, whose book, American Zion, Clive and Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West, which will be coming out on March 25th, continues our analysis of the use of Old Testament biblical worldview as an influence on our political, environmental, and future body politic. We hope you can join us then. But before we go, let us remember one of the greats among us who has left this mortal realm. On March 1st, 2020, Father Ernesto Cardenal died at the age of 95 in Managua, Nicaragua. Father Ernesto Cardenal, Nicaraguan poet, priest, and political revolutionary who wielded his pen as a weapon against two autocratic regimes. First, the Somoza family dynasty, which had labeled Father Cardenal the, quote, number one enemy of the people, end quote. And then his own Sandinista party, when it turned reactionary after Daniel Ortega took control in the early 1990s. Here I quote from the Washington Post column from March 3, 2020, headlined, Ernesto Cardenal, Nicaraguan poet, priest, and revolutionary, dies at 95. Quote, in a sign of his renown in Nicaragua, the government of Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega ordered 3 days of national mourning, despite having persecuted Father Cardenal after he resigned from the Sandinista National Liberation Front, the FSLN, in the early 1990s. Quote, it was a beautiful revolution, but what happened is that it was betrayed. End of quote. Father Cardenal told the Agence France-Presse in 2015, recalling his turn away from the Sandinistas, quote, there is now the family dictatorship of Daniel Ortega. That's not what we fought for. End of the quote. For many Nicaraguans, Father Cardenal was revered as a literary beacon and a moral authority, a Catholic priest who drew on Marx as well as the Gospels to champion social justice in his ministry and writings. One of Latin America's most acclaimed poets, he wrote verses that offered a cosmic fusion of spirituality, politics, science, and history while appearing at frequent lectures and readings that made him a kind of international ambassador for Nicaragua. Under the Somoza regime, he was cruelly tortured for his preaching of liberation theology. His poem about meeting his torturer after the success of the Sandinista Revolution was translated into a song recorded by Jackson Brown, My Personal Revenge. It remains one of the greatest manifestations of principled social justice rising above violent repression of social justice. Padre Ernesto Cardenal, presente.